Last year, the non-profit Center for Civil Liberties was one of three recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize, the first time ever that a Nobel Prize has been awarded to a Ukrainian citizen or organization. Ukrainian human rights lawyer Oleksandra Matvichuk started working for the organization, which she now heads, in 2007. She has been involved in a number of activities relating to the protection of human rights, including the collecting of evidence of Russian war crimes in Ukraine. When Czech radio's Jan Bumba interviewed her recently, he started by asking her what specifically she's focusing on right now. We bring you the full interview right here.
I want to find an answer: for whom do we document all these crimes for? Who will provide a chance for justice for hundreds of thousands of victims of this war? And it's not abstract question. Ukrainian national system is overloaded with an extreme amount of crimes. And International Criminal Court will limit an investigation only to several selected cases. So we need to change the world approach to war crime justice in order to achieve this goal.
How do you do it? What are you actually trying to do? Who do you want to address?
We need to convince international community to establish a special tribunal on aggression and hold Putin and high political leadership and top military command accountable. We also need to convince international community to ingrain international element into the level of national investigation and national justice in Ukraine, like a model where national prosecutors work together with international prosecutors, national judges work together with international judges.
When you say international community, who exactly do you mean? Is it the ICC or is it the UN? Which authority should be there to actually judge the deed?
This decision has to be taken by governments, which means that we have to convince people. Because a lot of things have no limitation in national borders. And justice is a very understandable value for everybody. When I describe the Russian war crimes which we documented, this pain, this horror is understandable to each person, regardless their nationality, their gender, their age, their social position, their citizenship, their ideology, their religion. Because first and foremost, we are all human beings.
At the same time, aren't Russians quite successful in gaining support from many countries, from many governments, including very influential China or India? So isn't it extremely difficult to convince the international community to put them on trial?
It's not easy task, but there is different reason why countries are not supported this idea. When I speak about China, let's remind ourselves that China commits horrible atrocities against their own citizens. They provide crimes against humanity, against Uyghur. They created a digital censorship. So there is no surprise that they will not fight for justice, because it's very bloody, unjust regime itself. But when we speak about India, India is democracy. So here we have to convince Indian politicians that they have to express the same values which they declare in their country in the external policy as well.
Do you think it's doable, actually?
It's doable, because when we speak about long-term approach, it means that you have to base your political decision on human rights values. This situation convincingly proves that when you base your political decision just on economical interest, you can benefit in short period, but in long period, you will pay much more. And this is the lesson which now well-development democracies are learned, because they closed their eyes for the violation in Russia for decades. They built gas pipeline, they made business as usual, they shake Putin's hand, and now we are all paying.
Which type of authority, which type of court could actually punish Russian war crimes?
The activities of International Criminal Court is extremely important in this regard. And I want once again emphasize the very historical decision of International Criminal Court to issue arrest warrant against Putin and his children, Commissioner Maria Lvova-Belova. Because what Putin did, he tried to convince the whole world that country with a strong military potential can dictate their rules to the international community. And International Criminal Court, with this decision, told, we don't care that you are a country with a strong military potential. We don't care that you are a country with nuclear weapon. We don't care that you are a country who are a member of UN Security Council. If you commit international crime, you will be responsible.
You once said in an interview, and I'll quote you, Russians believe they can do whatever they want. Your words. Why is that? Why do you think that happened?
Because Russians enjoyed impunity for decades. When we look what they did in Chechnya, what they did in Syria, it was inhuman. It was horrible atrocities, which had to be prosecuted. But they have never been punished. And that is why they start to believe they can do whatever they wanted. The bombarding to drama theater in Mariupol, while hundreds of people were there, it's a result of the same bombarding which Russia did in Aleppo, in Syria.
I understand your point. At the same time, most people don't commit crimes not because of the fear of punishment. I mean, we don't steal because we think that it's not right to steal.
It's another problem. It's a problem of Russian culture. It's not culture of Tchaikovsky or Dostoevsky or Russian ballet. It's a culture of violence. It's a culture of denial of human dignity. It's a culture of people who believe that they have a right to forcibly restore Russian empire. And that is why it's so important to show justice and to demonstrate justice. It can lead to very painful reflections which Russian people need to do, that it's not normal in 21st century to think like this.
And do you think that it's a matter of education, it's a matter of culture? What is it?
I think it's a matter of long-lasting impunity. I will describe it with some story which was told by my colleague, Russian human rights defenders. When Soviet Union collapsed, it was a discussion in Russian society, and some of groups promoted the idea that we have to start a historical process, legal process, against Stalin and crimes of communist regime. And this idea wasn't supported, because a lot of people said, everything is understandable. The people understood that it was a crime, that it was horror, that it was illegal. But what we see for current moment, Russia now promoting Stalin. Russia use the artificial version of history as a state ideology. Russia justified repressions and crimes committed during Soviet time. They closed historical center memorial because they show the unpleasant truth. And now when my Russian human rights colleagues remind about this discussion, they told, we failed. And it was a wrong decision.
Even in the West, there are people and political parties who are pro-Russian. They usually claim that they demand peace. Why do you think that's happening?
Because they think that peace can be achievable when country which was invaded stop fighting. But it will not be a peace. It will be occupation. And occupation is a state where people live in fear of constant violence. When they have no tools how to protect their rights, their liberties, their life, their property, and their beloved ones. I know what I'm talking about because I have been documenting war crimes for 9 years. And I personally interviewed hundreds of people who survived Russian captivity in occupied territories. They told me how they were beaten, how they were raped, how their fingers were cut, how they were tortured with electricity. It's horrible. It's not a peace. Occupation is just another form of war.
Are you still in the process of gathering the evidence, or do you think that you've got enough now, and your task now is to talk with the governments and with other people to establish some form of a court?
When large-scale invasion started, we united our efforts with dozens of civil organizations, mostly regional ones, into a Tribunal for Putin initiative, and we built all Ukrainian network of local documentators, and this work is going on daily. For current moment, we have in our database more than 36,000 episodes of war crimes. And now I personally concentrated on international advocacy to create the mechanisms of accountability. Because we do this job not just for national archives. We are not historians. We are human rights lawyers.
When you travel across Europe and across the world, does the response to your testimony vary in different countries?
Yes, there is different attitude whether or not the country expressed violence by themselves. For example, when I had a meeting with personnel of city council in Buenos Aires and told them about forcible kidnapping and adoption of Ukrainian children, I suddenly see people crying. And later, I remind myself, oh my God, but Argentina also suffered from this horrible practice. They know what I'm talking about. They have not just empathy. They have their own experience. So it's different because of the history of the country and the experience of people. But what is the same, that in all countries where I talk about human pain, Russian war crimes, and our fight for justice, ordinary people support our fight. Because once again, there is a lot of things which have no limitation of national borders, and human solidarity is one of such things.
Have you come across people who actually don't believe you, who would say that you're perhaps exaggerating or that the evidence is not clear enough or something like that?
Yes, and it's very understandable that the court will have the final decision, and all evidence which we gathered has to be presented in competitive court process where Russian military and Russian leadership will have their defendant. And they have right to protect themselves in a legal procedure. I will not convince anyone to believe me. Come to Ukraine and look to your own eyes what's going on.
Which Russians do you think should be put on trial? Should it be Vladimir Putin and his government? Should it be the military commanders? Should it be individual soldiers? Should it be, I don't know, Yevgeny Prigozhin? Who should be put on trial?
Everybody who committed international crimes. People who committed these crimes by their own hands. People who take decisions to commit these war crimes. People who provide orders to commit these war crimes. All people who contributed to make these crimes happen. I mean, so-called Russian journalists as well. I interviewed the young woman from Donetsk. She was taken into captivity because she has pro-Ukrainian sympathy. And she was severely beaten. And she begged not to beat her because she was pregnant. And she got an answer that you have pro-Ukrainian sympathy and your child have no right to be born. But later she was told that, okay, we will release you if you will tell to Russian journalist that you are a sniper. And she agreed. For sure she agreed just to survive. And one detail shocked me in her story the most. When this so-called Russian journalist arrived and understood that she is pregnant, they asked her to sit in a position to hide her pregnancy because it's ruined the whole plot.
You have also joined the debate about the Russian athletes being allowed back to international competitions. Why is it important? Would it make such a difference?
One of my personal moral leader is Václav Havel, and he told that we have to live in truth. And to live in truth, it means to name the things what they are. And we can't normalize killings, rapes, and tortures. We have to say that it's not normal. And while Russia will stop this, we will not interact with Russia in culture, in sport, and other fields, especially taking into account that these Russian athletes, in their majority, supported this war of aggression.
Which leads me to another question. Why do you think there are so many ordinary Russians, including sportsmen, who actually support the war?
Putin governed his country not just with repression and censorship. He governed Russia with a special social contract between Kremlin elites and ordinary Russians. And this social contract is based on Russian glory. And unfortunately, majority of Russians still see their glory in restoration of Russian Empire.
You've touched upon the topic of Ukrainian children being taken or perhaps kidnapped to Russia. According to ICC, at least hundreds of Ukrainian children have experienced this. Do you have more precise numbers or what are the estimates?
We are in the course of the war and it's very difficult to speak about numbers. Well, the last numbers which Ukrainian officials told it was 16,000. But we can't track each individual destiny. It's enough to say that we speak about systematic practice. It's not just sporadic or some occasional action. It's a policy of Russian state.
And you've also mentioned her name already, Maria Lvova-Belova. Russian's Commissioner for Children's Rights says that these children lived unattended, in poor conditions, and that they are better off in Russia. What do you say to that?
I will tell a concrete story of a family from Mariupol. The father brought up a three child, and he lived peacefully in Mariupol before large-scale invasion started. And then, in order to save his child's life, he decided to move to Russia because you know that Russians don't provide permission to International Committee of Red Cross to evacuate civilians from Mariupol to another region of Ukraine. And he didn't pass filtration. He was imprisoned. And his children were transferred to Russia and the process of forcible adoption started, regardless of the fact that they have father. And this is a story with a good ending because they released the father and the elder son find a way how to call his father and told that you have 5 days before adoption started and please come and save us. And he managed to did it. But there are a lot of things which we can't track.
So is this the usual destiny of these children, that they are put to forced adoption? That's what usually happens?
This is a component of the most broader policy. This war has a genocidal character. Remember, Putin openly said that there is no Ukrainian nation, that we are the same people as Russians. And this policy has a goal to forcibly change Ukrainian identity. And that is why we see that after occupation, Russians prohibited Ukrainian language. After occupation, Russians brought Russians teachers to the school to teach their version of history. And that is why they provide this illegal transfer of Ukrainians' children to Russia for forcible adoption.
You have also expressed sympathy to the family of the Russian activist Vladimir Karamurza, who was sentenced to 25 years in prison a few days ago. And you also wrote that you are sure that Putin's regime will fall much sooner. How stable do you think is today's regime in Russia?
Unfortunately, as I told before, majority of Russians support this war of aggression. And I don't believe in any possibility of mass protest against Putin in Russia. But Putin started this war in 2014 when Ukraine obtained a chance for a democratic transformation after the collapse of authoritarian regime due to Revolution of Dignity. Because he was afraid that idea of freedom come closer to Russian border. So success of Ukraine will provide a chance for democratic future of Russia itself. And that is why when I speak with my Russian human rights colleagues, how we can support you for all these years, they have the same response. If you want to help us, please be successful.
How has the war experience changed Ukraine itself and the Ukrainian nation?
In this war, we're fighting for freedom in all senses. For freedom to have our own state and not to be a Russian colony. And for freedom to be Ukrainians and not to be forcibly re-educated as Russians. And for freedom to have our own democratic choice and to build the country where the rights of everybody are protected. And we pay a high price just for a chance to build such a country. And each Ukrainian knows about it.
Can you imagine what the relations between Russians and Ukrainians may look like in 10 years, in 15 years?
It's very difficult to predict. We have to win this war with Russia, which means to think, first, we need to push out Russian troops from Ukrainian territory and deoccupy Crimea and other Ukrainian territories. But second, we need to succeed in democratic transition of our country and build sustainable democratic institutions. And this means that when we will do it, it will have a huge impact to Russia and to other countries in our region as well. And then when it happened, we can try to build another system of peace and security in region, because the current one are not able to prevent such bloody war as we have for current moment.
If I may ask a little bit more personal question, you were named among the 100 most influential people in the world by the American magazine Time. How influential do you feel yourself?
I'm ordinary human rights lawyer, but the demand of millions of people for justice is very powerful too. And that is why I feel that I'm not alone. There are a lot of people who support our fight for bringing Putin and other Russian war criminals accountable.
I actually only have perhaps one or two more questions, and that is whether the Nobel Prize has helped. Does it open doors?
Yes, because for decades the voice of human rights defenders from our region wasn't heard in the rooms where political decisions were taking place. We was invited and we was heard only in such a platform like UN Human Rights Council or UN Human Rights Committee or OAC Human Rights Dimension annual meeting, etc. And now I think it's a very important process of rethinking started in the world, that when you based your political decision not on human rights, it will lead to a bad result.
Is your work appreciated back home in Ukraine? Are you a well-known person in Ukraine?
Human rights defenders are not celebrities. Our human rights organizations are known in Ukraine by our ability to involve ordinary people into our work. So I do believe that we can't leave human rights just for lawyers, diplomats, or experts. It has to become a general job.
Thank you very much indeed for the interview. Thank you.
Thank you.